Hello, listeners, and this is your host Ashwin on the show In Conversation with Ashwin. So welcome to yet another edition. There's not been too many episodes, sorry, and my apologies for that. Just been actually, I haven't been able to find any guests. Mostly if I email my guests, they're like they don't respond, or they're like, hey, you know what, we will speak at this time on this day, but don't really show up. And I'm like, try to schedule it again and again, but it doesn't happen. So yeah, that's been happening. Finally, we have somebody interesting today. She is an old friend from school. Her name is Asmita. She's graduated from IIT. In fact, I'll let her say hi first before I go ahead. Hi, Asmita. How's it going with
Hi, Ashwin. Thank you for having me. And
Welcome to the show. So essentially, what we're trying to discuss today is the theme is feminism, and I think our guest completely fits the whole topic of discussion, because now she works in Delhi as digital editor of Feminism in India, which is a magazine where she writes, edits, and also tweets for a living. So tell us more about your job. What got you interested into this, and how's the whole feminism drive making you choose it as a career option, at least in the beginning?
yeah, I mean, I don't know about long-term career option, but for now, well, I just this is my first job out of college, and I feel like the job, the requirements of the job fit in perfectly with what I was passionate about, which was writing. And also, like, I was always a very vocal feminist from college. Well, I became a feminist, or I understood feminism in college thanks to a course on feminism. But I also understand when a lot of people have misconceptions about feminism, because I had the privilege of learning about it, like learning feminist theory in a course. So it's I mean, I understand if, people misunderstand it sometimes, or don't get what it's about, or think it's, completely what think that it's completely not what it is. So anyway, so that I got in, I became a feminist in my second year of college, and so that's something I was always very passionate about. And then this job sort of combined those interests of writing about feminism, I mean, writing and feminism. And well, right now I don't do a lot of writing, because my work is more about the whole digital media part of it. But yeah, I mean, writing used to be what I did a lot. And yeah.
Fair enough. Fair enough. In fact, I've read a lot about what you've written, and I think I read every time you post on social media, or if it appears on my feed, I'm like, okay, it's either dog posts or feminism posts that come up mostly. It's pretty interesting. We'll talk about one of the pieces that I really liked about what you wrote, but yeah, in the beginning, there's this whole Me Too campaign that just started recently. Post the Harvey Weinstein. How is that pronounced? Weinstein? Weinstein.
Weinstein, I don't know. Yeah, Weinstein, I think.
Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts? Like, how did you look at the whole? I think it gained a huge uproar, and rightly so. A lot of people came out with their stories, and listeners, for those of you who probably not caught up, the Me Too campaign was a very recent campaign started by the actress Alyssa Milano. It was basically popularized by her. I don't think it was started by her, it was started by somebody else. In fact, she encouraged women to tweet in public to just demonstrate their experiences about the widespread nature of misogynistic behavior that exists in our
And sexual
society.
harassment, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I think millions of people use the hashtag to
Yeah.
just come out of the experiences, many celebrities too. So, yeah. What are your thoughts? How did you see this, and how did it trickle down in your company? Was there any activism around that? What did you hear?
So I found out about Me Too just probably like everyone did, just scrolling through my Facebook, and I saw a couple of people having status updates about it, and I was like, okay, what's going on? And then I saw more and more and more people, and I think it was an incredibly powerful movement, because just from my personal like the way I thought about it, not from a work capacity, but just from a personal capacity, is I was like, whatever, I'm not going to talk about this. Honestly, I've written about my experiences of sexual harassment, so I was like, I'm not really going to join, get in on this bandwagon, because whatever, I don't feel like, you know, dredging up those things right now. But then I saw more and more people talk about it, and it felt really powerful just hearing everyone sort of, there was just a sense of solidarity building around it. And as I saw more and more people talk about it, I was like, you know what, I should talk about it, because I think it was so powerful because of the sheer numbers of people, which is exactly what it was meant to do. And I am so stunned at the power of social media, honestly, because everyone, I mean, there's this, you know, it's popular to be like, oh, what are you doing with your Facebook posts and your social media activism? What does it even do? Like, are you making any real change? And because, of course, feminism is only about empowering the oppressed rural women. And like, if you're not really helping them, then what are you even doing? That's one of the, you know, one of the ways that people think that social media activism is bullshit. But I think it was incredibly powerful because, like, just from a personal, from the way I reacted to it, I didn't want to talk about it. And then I saw so many other people talking about it, and I felt like solidarity with them. And then I wanted to talk about it. And I think for a lot of women, it was like, I am also active in this sphere of activism and writing and talking, but a lot of people just don't talk about it, or they talk about it behind closed doors with their girlfriends. I mean, for sure, every woman has talked about it with their girlfriends, with their friends. It's just a thing. Like, I don't even know how many conversations I've had about sexual harassment. I don't know. We're just talking in university about random things like term papers and professors, and then suddenly it just turns into a conversation about sexual harassment, and everybody has something to say, and everybody has like younger and younger years when it first started happening to them. So I think all women know that all women have faced it, but, and it's really eye-opening when we realize that most men have no idea how pervasive it is. And because for us, it's such a lived reality, and it's so everyday. Harassment is so everyday that it's insane for us to know, realize that, you know, all the people we know and love, like all the men in our lives, probably don't even have an idea of how widespread or how normalized it is. And and also, I think the language of feminism also helps you understand what harassment is, because when I was, I don't know, like the first time I was harassed or whatever, I was like 11 years old, and I was ashamed. I was like, whoa, shit, you know, someone just, I don't know, touched me inappropriately, but oh God, like, what did I do? And I was really embarrassed, and I, you know, hunched up my shoulders and walked with my head down. And that's sort of the vocabulary around it, where you're made to feel ashamed for it, and I think feminism helps you to realize that it's not your fault, and you are not the problem. So, and it helps you look at the larger, it's not just one incident that happened to you, but it's this larger entire system of violence that operates against women. So anyway, I deviated a bit because we were talking about Me Too, and I think Me Too was so powerful just because of the, like you said, the magnitude of it. And actually, like in the Indian context, actually all over the world, it's become like a revelatory moment in feminist politics, I think, because all over the world, it started out as, you know, Facebook, it started out with Harvey Weinstein, which was huge because, you know, he's a huge producer and he's done some of the biggest movies that we've all seen and watched, and he's very, very powerful. But then it started this domino effect of everyone talking about all the powerful men that have abused them. And in India, that has come out in the form of Raya Sarkar's list. I don't know if you've heard about that.
Yeah.
But, and of course, there are a lot of mixed opinions about this, because it's just a little bit of background for someone who's not followed this conversation that's happening around Raya Sarkar's list. What happened was, because of Me Too, a lot of people started speaking out about sexual harassment, and Raya Sarkar is this student who used to study in India, but now she's based in Singapore, I think, or the US, I'm not sure. Singapore. They actually go by the pronoun they. So they published, they made a status update which talked about a professor in university who harassed them, and then they also said that anyone who's been harassed by a professor can write to me personally and I will publish that list. And then there was this list of academics and professors, and not, you know, not in engineering colleges, because this was mostly like limited, or so far has been limited to the left, liberal, progressive. So these are progressive academics who have all been named under charges of sexual harassment, in some cases more. And it caused a huge stir, because these are people I have read in my college days. I have read papers written by them. And these are professors that we all know and love. I mean, I don't know about love, but we all know. And yeah, they are extremely respected. And so everyone was stunned at the names on that list. And there was also a huge backlash, because by feminists themselves. So this has actually caused this rift in the feminist movement in India. Actually, there's a great article about it on Daily O. I forget the writer's name, but it talks about the rift that this has caused in the Indian feminist movement, because a bunch of older feminists like Kavita Krishnan, Nivedita Menon has written an extremely famous book called Seeing Like a Feminist, which is one of like the hallmarks of Indian feminist literature or whatever. So a bunch of older feminists wrote a letter on the portal Kafila condemning this list, and they said that due process should have been followed, and this is creating a culture of naming and shaming, and anyone can be named on that list, and they have no mode to provide a defense, they have no mode, they don't even know who's accusing them. So this is completely unfair for the people who've been named, and the people who've written, who've, you know, put their name, who've made these accusations, should have followed due process and the institutions in place to convict these people, like go through their institutes, CCASH, which is like the Committee Against Sexual Harassment, or, you know, put in a formal complaint, etc.
Yeah.
And so that was a big, like, there were people on both sides of the spectrum. Some people completely empathized with the survivors who had put out these names, and there were other people who were like, you know, this anonymity is not good. But I stand on the side of Raya Sarkar and the list because, and I understand that this anonymity is a very complicated concept, because at one point, it is scary to be named for sexual harassment, and you don't know, you know, who did it, but in all with most likely you do know, you know, because it is, sexual harassment is what Me Too has taught us, is sexual harassment is incredibly pervasive, and the people who have made these, like who have been named, they are some of the most powerful people in academia, right? And this due process that the older feminists in Kafila wrote about, that really doesn't exist for women in a lot of ways. And after this, there's been so many conversations around it where people have written back to those women who wrote that article in Kafila about naming and shaming, and said, you know what, I followed due process and nobody gave a shit. Like, sorry about the language, but I
You're okay to use the drop the F bomb, yeah, as well. It's fine.
Okay.
I think the whole profanity will just, don't let it restrict what you're trying to say.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So there have been people who've written articles saying, I complained to my college committee on sexual harassment. I have written letters to the fucking police. I mean, to the government about so-and-so professor at so-and-so university. And what happened? Nothing. They're still on tenure. They're still, you know, teaching at the highest levels. And I am getting harassed by the university administration, saying that, you know, what I'm saying isn't true. And like, there was someone who had attempted suicide because of the struggle to get her sexual harassment claims listened to, you know, and what is this due process when our judiciary makes judgments which say things like a feeble no may not really be a no. And because she said no, I'm talking about the Mohammed Farooqi case, but that was again a very, very strong and powerful man in left liberal act, like in the left liberal circles, and the court judged in favor, and they said that because she didn't say no strongly enough, that's not, consent could have been said to be given, so he didn't rape her. I mean, if our judiciary has trouble understanding what consent means, which is only the presence of a yes, not the absence of a no.
Speaking about consent, I think even, I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, but marital rape is not a crime in India.
Yeah. So,
in fact, consensual sex between the same gender is... that's funny to know.
Exactly. It's messed up to note. So you know, and if that's our due process and if those are our systems, what are we left with? And what has this list done? It's only created awareness and it's created, I mean, so I'm not 100% sure that all of those men listed on that, list are dangerous, but as a student starting out in that, if I've read that list, I will be careful. And that's something, if it saves one student from being harassed or one student from being taken advantage of, then, I mean, I am completely in favor of the list, because naming and shaming is dirty, but it's necessary, because sexual harassment is dirty, you know. Sexual harassment is messed up and it's silenced. Nobody fucking talks about it. So I think what Raya Sarkar has done is have gotten people to talk about it, you know. So that's
I think that's what Me Too has done at a global level. Right? You know, an incidental effect of the Me Too campaign, however small, is this podcast actually. Because I feel like when I saw those Facebook posts, friends that I know, friends that I've spoken to but have never told me about these things actually came out on Facebook. I'm like, hey, you haven't mentioned this to me when we've been speaking, but you've come out on Facebook and hashtag Me Too, which is the power of this moment.
Yeah, for sure. It created this, I think women, what Me Too did was it created a safe space. Women felt like there are so many other women talking about it, so I can too, you know. And
absolutely,
I think it's very liberating. And being able to speak about it is actually very liberating. It's a very liberating process for survivors to be able to talk about it and receive support. And
exactly as you said, right, this whole social media activism is something that's frowned upon. You're like, hey, what are you doing on Facebook? But this Me Too campaign quickly surpassed that whole because of the kind of volumes that this was generating. I was like, okay, I believe in this already. Like, I'm going to read every Me Too post that is going to appear on my feed and actually sympathize from wherever I am, because that's the most I can do at this point, at least.
Yeah, I know. And I think social media activism, what does it do? It creates conversations, and conversations change the world. So I don't think, you know, social media activism is bullshit or whatever. So
Fair enough. Speaking about that, in fact, I feel like you're doing a great job yourself, so thank you for, you know, taking one for the whole like team, and you're standing up and doing. In fact, one of the articles that you wrote was something that I was reading over the past couple of days, because I like to spend some time researching and stalking my guests, like, hey, are they worth speaking to? I'm kidding.
Well, I'm glad I met your criteria.
I particularly like the whole, it was very brave of you to confess the whole harassment that you've personally gone through. And then these two lines actually stood out to me. I'm going to actually read it out, if you don't mind, for the listeners.
Sure.
It says, as a woman occupying a public space, I'm first and foremost a female body and second only a human being. As a woman, my body takes center stage, awaiting appraisal before my words and opinions are taken stock of. Like what made you write this whole women in public spaces and how you treat it as an object first and then as a person?
Yeah, this was the first article I ever wrote, and this was when I hadn't even joined Feminism in India yet, and I was just thinking about, you know, what affects me the most like every day, in the most everyday manner, or the most pervasive thing is how women's experiences of public spaces. But actually, just before I talk about this, I want to put out a caveat, because Harassment, sexual harassment of women is almost always only talked about in terms of public spaces. And this is something that I formed an opinion about after I had written this piece. Otherwise, I would have mentioned this in the piece that I had written. But that idea is very like, it's actually just wrong that sexual harassment happens in public spaces, only in public spaces. Because the minute you say sexual harassment, you think, oh, in a bus, in the park, in the dark, right? But sexual harassment or sexual abuse actually happens within families and within houses and by your family friend, uncle, or family, or by respectable people in universities, you know, and those are the respectable people, or, you know, people within your social background who come from the same caste and class background as you. And those men are never called out as being sexual harassers. This is exactly why Raya Sarkar's list was also so shocking, because these are respectable men and nobody talks about the sexual harassment that respectable men do. And the whole talking about sexual harassment in public spaces, I'm not saying that that's not an issue. It's a huge issue, but it also gets tinted with classism and casteism, because you only think a certain kind of man sexually harasses you. The man who is from a lower income background, or the man who is an other in any way from different religious background, different class background, different caste background. Yeah. And only those kind of men harass you. And there is a really good book called Why Loiter, which I read, which made me develop this this understanding, because what that sort of rhetoric does is it excludes women from public spaces, because, you know, my father will tell me, don't go out there. There are those kind of men there and they will harass you. So you don't go out, you stay inside. So my engagement with public spaces gets limited. And similarly, the police will be like, ha, tum utke chale jao. Like those kind of men, again, those kind of men are again excluded from public spaces because they are seen as vagrants or deviants, you know, and that's a huge class caste bias that's operating in there, because that's not true, you know, like literally anyone, any man can be a harasser. And sorry if that sounds really crude, but from all of our women lived experience, that's what you're taught, that's what you like understand. So So before I talk about public spaces, I just wanted to put in that caveat that it's not just public spaces where women get harassed. It's inside doors, inside closed doors, in respectable institutions by respectable men, so-called. And yeah, so I just wanted to talk about that. But but going back to my article on public spaces. Yeah, so public spaces are where you're made aware of your womanness very acutely. Actually, not just public spaces, this is to do with my experience as a woman anywhere, right? With my friends, with the people I hang out with, I am made very aware that I'm a woman, especially when I hang out with guys. I can give you an example. I was hanging out with a couple of guys, and I don't want to name them obviously, but we were talking about getting something done. Like we had to go convince somebody to I don't want to give a lot of detail because then it gets obvious who I'm talking about. But we had to basically convince some people to grant us an opportunity. Yeah. And they said, I was with two men and they're friends of mine. And they said, Asmita, you go do it, man. Like, why don't you go talk to them? Because, you know, they'll say yes to you. And, you know, and then they sort of gestured like my boobs or whatever, you know, like, you know, you're attractive. You're like an attractive woman. Why don't you go talk to them?
They'll get you. I'm guessing the person you were going to
was a man for sure, so I am there in a capacity as a human being. Like I'm just with these two other guys and we all want that same opportunity that we're looking for at that point. And I have, you know, boobs, and therefore I have the capacity to be objectified, and therefore I should use that in our collective favor to get that opportunity, you know. So that's so messed up. And these are guys, I don't know, they didn't think that there was anything wrong in saying something like that. But And what am I reduced to? I'm reduced to my body. I'm reduced to the fact that I have boobs and like something that a man will find attractive, you know? So that's, and that's not public spaces. This was with my friends in my friend's house, by the way. So yeah, that happens to women all the time. You're always aware of your body. Like you can never forget your body. You can never go beyond your body because everyone's looking at your body. Everyone's looking not at your face, the rest of your body. Yeah. Everyone is, there's just a different vibe when there's a woman around, you know, there's, oh, is that's a woman, you know, she's a woman. Yeah. It's not like a regular person. She's a woman. So that's, and you're always, especially in all male spaces, because I do hang out outside of work, which is mostly a women only space. I do hang out with a lot of men only. Okay. And whenever I'm in these, like where there's a majority of men, I can never forget that I'm a woman, because that
even,
is
even when you're with your friends.
Maybe not like my best friends, but definitely acquaintances. Yeah. And I don't know, like, any social situations where I'm one of the few women there. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I wouldn't say this of my best friends, I guess. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. But it's definitely very pervasive. And yeah. So that's what I meant when I wrote that, because you can't ever forget that you're a woman. You're never allowed to forget
To. Even if you do, there's someone reminding you very subtly with either an expression, look, or just a side comment. And then suddenly you're very, it's difficult to deal with. Fair enough.
Yeah, and that's why staring is so uncomfortable. Staring, you can't really say anything because, you know, they didn't touch you and they didn't do anything to you, but everyone is always staring.
That in itself is offense. I don't know how you can detect a stare that is extremely malicious, but if there was a machine to detect that, then there'd be 1,000 people going to jail every day.
Yeah, it's... I mean, all stares. I mean, why are they looking at you? They're looking at you because they look at you. It's like you're like this piece of meat.
I mean, you get to know when a stare is just like a passing stare, or a stare that is very consciously imagining or fantasizing.
Looking, exactly. And that happens to me every single day. Every time I walk out to the metro station and walk to the women's compartment, I have like these, like, all these eyes on me every time I walk, and every woman does not. So yeah, it's quite disconcerting when that happens.
There's obviously stares from women to men also that we can speak about, but we will leave that for another podcast.
I actually want to talk about that because, of course, okay, so let's not pretend like we are attracted to people, and we do check out the people that we are attracted to. I check out guys. Okay. So I'm that, but this is like a systemic thing, right? And so there's a difference, because I don't check out every single guy that I look at, but like every time a man doesn't feel this on the scale that I feel it, right? If a man walks by and someone looks at him, a man's going to feel, you know, cool about himself for the most part.
No,
he's
going
to be like, oh, hey, she's checking me out. That's cool. And a woman feels creeped out. And why do you think that there's a difference in that? That's because of the scale of it and the way that it's done, because it's a systemic thing when it comes
also,
to...
Yeah, it's also because of the kind of experiences that women have because of being stared at, and the consequences of it versus men being stared at, and the consequences of that is not too much. They're probably just going to talk about him, but you're not going to act as much as a...
Exactly. And also it's the level, it's the magnitude of it, and it's the way that it operates on I keep using this word systemic, like it's not one man staring at me, it's like it's how objectification and patriarchy functions, that they will, like, it'll operate on this wider level to make me feel really uncomfortable every time I'm out.
Yeah.
And that's not what a man experiences at all. So, you know, you can't like sort of equate those two experiences and say, oh man, but even you check out guys and like, you know,
you can't.
So
absolutely. Yeah. So how do you deal with this? Like being stared at, and is writing a way to vent? How do you deal with it?
I've actually been reading like different women, like a lot of women like write about this on their social media, on how do they deal with getting stared at, and how does it's for a lot of women, it's just ignore because it's so everyday, well, and you don't have the energy to.
Yeah, but what would you like for someone like you who is in a space that is empowering, and you have the ability to make a change just with the job that you're doing? What would be your say 2 cents to somebody, to any other woman, any other lady listening to this, about how they can deal with just stares or just experiences that are just elephants in the rooms?
Oh, I don't wanna, you know, because my job or my position in this feminist space doesn't give me, like, every woman has her coping mechanisms, because every woman has dealt with this since she was like 10 years old, you know. So like every woman has her knows what to do, and I am no one to, you know, tell other women what to do. I mostly ignore. There was this one tactic I employed for some time, which is I wanted to stare back at them, which worked with a few men. When I stared back at them, they would drop their eyes, but sometimes I would stare back at them and they would stare back at me, and then it turned into like a staring competition, and I would try to be like to win it out, but sometimes they just wouldn't drop their stare, so I would be even more uncomfortable and drop it. But yeah, everyone has, you know, ways that they deal with it, and mostly it's just ignore, because honestly, you don't have the brain space or emotional space to deal with every man staring at you. That's just, it's so rampant that you're just like, okay, I'm going to pretend it didn't happen, because my headspace can't get ruined because of this, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to actually discuss today was, you know, the second nature subtleties that exist within us. For example, there's so many assumptions and so many things that we say just like that without thinking that are extremely dangerous, because we've never been warned of it in the past that, hey, what you're saying is wrong. We almost consider it to be a normal thing. And let me just give you a story to make things like simpler.
Okay.
In fact, just over the weekend when I came here, I was trying to clean things up and really set my space. And I was doing a lot of domestic things. When somebody asked me how the weekend is going, I just told them, hey, I'm doing a lot of mom things. And that in itself, I felt like, and the person I was speaking to was a girl, and she's quite an active feminist herself. And she stopped me right there and she said, listen, take that back. What do you mean mom things? Why wouldn't your dad do something like this? I'm like, hey, first he wouldn't, because I know my dad. But yeah, what you said makes sense. These are things that you get reminded of and suddenly stopped at. And it's ridiculous, right? I'm not able to think of too many examples, but I personally am a victim of these things. And I think the Indian scenario doesn't stop you and warn you, saying, remind. And then you're exposed in a different setting, and then suddenly what you said is just frowned upon, and you're like, hey, why am I getting this sort of a treatment? I said it 100 times before, but nobody stopped me.
Yeah.
And no woman actually stops you sometimes, because even they don't feel like what you said was anything that was wrong. So
I mean, that's something we all struggle with. Me too, and everybody, I think, because you learn patriarchy, right? You learn conditioning, you learn gender roles. That's what you're brought up with, and that's what society reinforces off of you. And being a feminist, or if you're wanting to become a feminist or any kind of social justice movement, it requires a lot of unlearning. That's actually the hardest thing about being committing to a social justice cause, is unlearning all of the biases that you have been conditioned with. And that's hard. And like, I'm not going to villainize you because you said that, because we all have conditioning, right? Like, we are all conditioned. But what you can do is, if someone calls you out, don't get defensive, recognize it. Okay. So like, think about it. What does this mean? What are the larger implications of what I'm saying? Yeah. And then maybe try to take it out of your vocabulary. It's hard though, because especially with swear words, right? It's really hard to not say motherfucker, because you're so used to saying that if that's your swear word of choice. But most swear words are somehow denigrating to women. Yeah. And it's hard. It's really hard to stop swearing in a particular way that is sexist. I mean, swear, say fucker for all I care, you know. But so it's hard, and it requires unlearning, but it just... I guess you just have to be patient about it and not get defensive when someone calls you out.
Not being defensive, when someone calls you out on it, just recognize it, say, yeah, got to improve on that. And
think about it and try, just try. And this is also like another example is saying that's so gay, you know, like someone wears something that you don't approve of. And you're like, that's so gay, man. That's really offensive again. And no one, I might be completely pro LGBTQ rights and completely sensitive and for like LGBTQ rights again, but still say that's so gay because that's what I've been saying for the last 10 years. And so then it's hard. I need to stop, but I do need to stop saying that because every time I say that's so gay, a person who might be closeted will feel shitty about himself or herself, you know, and think that, okay, so my masculinity, like if I come out as gay, my masculinity will be made fun of because like even when she doesn't know I'm gay, she's saying this and she's making fun of something that's not so masculine and saying it's gay. So if I come out as gay, my masculinity is going to be threatened. And so maybe I won't come out. So the words can have crazy impact, you know? And so it's just about like trying to recognize what you can, like how you can do better, basically.
Yeah, that's the key thing. Just recognize, stop and say, what are the larger implications? And
And it's the same thing about humor because a lot of people get pissed. I mean, this is one of the charges leveled against feminists that we have no sense of humor and everything, like we have to take everything seriously. But no, actually, I think humor can be really funny even when it's not making fun of a particular race or class or gender who are historically already made fun of. So this is like a really easy concept, punch up, not down, right? So if women have been systematically oppressed for generations and you want to make a wife joke, it's funny only to the men of the audience and women. And okay, women too, like there's internalized misogyny. You internalize that, haha, we should be made fun of. So this is funny. So I'm going to laugh at it. But just punch up, right? Like humor, there can be like ridiculously funny humor, which doesn't rely on...
doesn't target the historically targeted ones.
It doesn't target like those who are already oppressed or...
Yeah, for example, I went for this is off, this is the off, off the topic, but when I went for the roast of AIB in Bombay, I actually attended the roast. And Ashish Shakya, the guy was black and he's still black, but the rest of the people who were roasting him essentially took up on that black joke and it wasn't funny after and it just was like, okay guy, like get more creative, man, like what is that?
I mean, so when I'm accused of being, you know, a feminist killjoy or whatever, I was like, no, just work a little bit harder on your jokes, man. I will laugh at your joke if it's funny, but it's if you have to like make fun of women or black people or like dark people like Ashish Shakya or fat people or lower caste people to be funny, then I'm sorry, but I just don't find you funny. So like I think it was Ashish Shakya who also made like a bunch of Mayawati jokes, and that's again, she is from oppressed caste and a woman and has, you know, and has obviously had to face a lot to get to being the CM. So like making fun, like I think his joke was about her having facial hair. So like what is the message? What are you saying? That if a woman has facial hair and if a woman does not fit your conventional standards of beauty, let's make fun of her and let's make her the butt of a joke that everybody can laugh at, right? That's not funny. So
it's just ridiculous. In fact, if I had 20 more minutes, I could actually pull up or like really top names and them being victims to really stupid statements. Like I remember Digvijay Singh saying something around, hey, you know what, women shouldn't wear skirts and come out in the night, they're calling for rape. Like those are the kind of things that our government says, right?
We have a whole segment on this on Feminism in India called That's What They Said, and we call out all these ridiculous statements that politicians and people in power say.
It's needs so much work. But speaking about so essentially that's mostly it. Do you want to add anything else about just the whole feminism and the recent uproar and how men and women should be both sensitive and cognitive about these things?
Yeah, I mean, I would just encourage people to not brand feminism as something that's like fucked up and like just take a minute to try and understand what it's about without, you know, denigrating it before you actually understand what it's about, because at its core is just about equality. So yeah, and so I would just request your listeners to
Yeah.
give feminism a chance and think about it, because yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and it makes a lot of sense to understand the world
It
around
does.
us.
It does. It
Yeah.
does. And we the world is patriarchal, not only the country. And let's
Yeah.
accept the fact that we are on unequal levels at this point, and it needs effort to get back on top. And that's why feminism needs more of the
Yeah.
support. And that's why I love feminism and I love feminists and
Yeah.
really all
That's
feminists.
actually exactly what you said was exactly right, because people are like, oh, but you know, if it's feminism, why isn't it equalism? Because if you want people to be equal, why are you talking about women's
Oh,
rights?
yeah,
And
that
that
argument.
just requires you to recognize that men are at a higher footing than women are in today's world. So if you want a equal justice movement, you need to prop up the women, or you need to prop up the oppressed sections in whatever, in terms of whatever
Yeah,
axis,
I
like
mean,
caste or
people who are
class.
making that argument
So
aren't taking facts into account. How many CEOs are actually women? How many
yeah,
women are actually in the
I
government of
think
any country?
it's just, yeah, it's also about taking stock of your own privilege, and that's a very uncomfortable process. So you're like, I didn't ask for this, right? Like, you can be like,
Yeah.
I'm a man. I haven't harassed anyone. So why are men being, you know, villainized like this? But you need to like just stop taking everything personally, and then look at yourself, and then look at the life of someone who's from a different background as you, and then recognize your privilege. I think checking your privilege is a huge process that everyone needs to do, and then
Yeah.
that'll maybe get them to be more empathetic to social justice movements. Like, I, for me, actually, another article that I would, this is a bit of a self plug, but I would want this article to be read, is an article that I've written on feminism in India called Privilege 101. I think it's called Privilege and Oppression 101. And yeah,
We'll
because
add
there,
that.
which
We'll
is,
add the link on the comment on the description
Yeah,
box.
because I think like checking your privilege, and for me, it's like I'm an upper class woman, and I have a whole lot of privilege that shields me from a lot of oppression that women from other backgrounds face. So,
Yeah.
yeah, so that's something that I think everyone, like just looking at your privilege is something, is a very important exercise,
Yeah.
I think.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Before
Yeah.
you go, just to end on a lighter note,
Yeah.
as serious and important as this is,
Yeah.
talk to us about your moment of fame. Listeners, for example, for those of you who don't know, Asmita actually posted a video from her YouTube account which hit 1 million views. It's unbelievable. In fact, it's basically a parody of the Carly J. Jepsen song "Call Me Maybe." There was two other girls, and they rewrote the lyrics to the song in the style of an Indian matrimonial ad. You should check the video out.
Yeah.
For the listeners, I'm actually going to post a link of the YouTube video in the description box. It's called "Be a Pundati." Tell us more,
Yeah.
Smita. How did that come out, and how did you feel when it hit like 10,000, 20,000, and you're like, okay, this is too much, and then it hit 1 million
Yeah.
views.
That was just insane. It was some stupid thing that we did at 3 a.m. in the night. I'm just like an enthusiastic person in life. So there was some stupid competition in our college, which was like, make a parody. And I had my friend Anu Kripa, and I was like, oh my God, let's participate in it. And if we win, we'll win 3,000 rupees, and let's just do it. Let's just do it. And she's like, oh my God, Asunda, please don't make me do this. Let's do it. And then we just sat at night and rewrote that the lyrics to "Call Me Maybe" in this, yeah, like a matrimonial. And then yeah, it was so, it's so like the if you
So
watch the
wait,
video,
it just took you a few hours in the night to come up with this?
yeah, it was
Wow.
just like a lark. And
That's
then
the
we it was just to win that competition, okay? And then suddenly, like, I remember when it hit like 1,000 views, and we were super excited. We're like, what is happening? And then I was like, dude, you know what? I think it's gonna hit 5,000 views. And Anu was like, what? No, don't be silly. Like, maybe 1,500, like 500 more, that's it, and we're done. And I'm like, no, I think this is gonna hit 5,000. And then it just like, yeah, I think Story Pick or something picked it up, and it blew up. Yeah, it was
yeah,
like my 15
crazy.
minutes of fame 1 year ago. But yeah, it's like my claim to fame.
That is
Yeah.
insane. That is insane. Yeah, Congratulations, though. I mean, it's
Thank
something that you can
you.
actually put on your resume. Made a video that got a million
Yeah,
views.
it's totally on my resume, man.
Yeah.
It's like my, in fact, my boss at Feminist Zone India hired me because of this. Like, she was like, oh, you have video making abilities and all, so you should join. And then later I had to tell her, like, actually, that did not require a lot of, like, video making ability at all.
Yeah.
It was very basic. And she's like, what? I thought, okay, maybe don't put this part on the podcast.
I'm definitely
going to. Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, it's totally on my resume.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And well-deserved. Thanks, Asuka. Thanks for actually
Thank
taking the time out and speaking about
yeah.
something that's so important. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Ashwin, for having me.
Thank you.